Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Steve and I cover the season finale of season 7. We say goodbye to Littlefinger. We find out that Jon won't lie to save his life or anyone else's life. That we see Jon and Dany hook up. But most importantly, the Night King has a dragon and the wall has been breached. Here is my friend, comic Steve Osborne. Steve, I'm going to ask you a question about a scene that we've seen twice in Visions. All right. So this scene, you may remember, it's the throne room of the Iron Throne at King's Landing. And it looks like either ash is falling because the roof is gone, right. Or it could be either ash or snow.
Right.
And here we are at the end of season 7. Do you have a sense
of which it is?
Of which it is, and which would, like, what would be the implications for either one?
Right. So I had always interpreted it as ash.
Uh huh. Sure.
Just because of that sort of falls in line with the lore of what we had heard from, you know, like the dragons and the dragon being the reason why we have this idea of that's how Dany could potentially win.
Right.
And I think because I don't know a lot about the meteorology of Westeros. I don't know how much snow King's Landing gets. So in order for it to be snow, it would have to be that winter's a bigger deal than we realize, or there's some other way to get snow there.
Well, we know that the Night King kind of brings winter with him, right?
So, well, yes, and I mean, I guess, but I've never seen him outside of where winter is, so I don't know.
Sure, that's true.
So that's where I'm like, is it just a byproduct of like what he has access to, like, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So, but
you've always interpreted it as ash.
I've always
right?
interpreted it as ash, and now I have this, like, again, if I'm following my own path, I could be like, ooh, that could be snow. Because the snow never made sense to me. But now, if I'm like, well, if the Night King, at least, he doesn't necessarily have to win, but at least if he's there doing some damage, then that certainly, this becomes the big fire and ice battle, right? Because the visions from Melisandre was this, I think our assumption was, oh, well, this is going to be when everyone goes up north to fight. But like, what if it's south that this fight goes because they've already breached the wall, so who knows how much more south they can get before that fight takes place, right?
Yeah.
We already know that there's an element of Cersei and her armies that she's getting some like mercenary team or something from Braavos. Is that what?
Yeah, the Golden Company. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my understanding, if I'm tracking all that correctly, is that's to kind of hold. Gain a little ground while everybody else is distracted, and then whatever's left, they feel like that, like it's one of two things, right? Either they're all going to lose to the Night King, and she's just like, well, we're just going to keep on doing this until we can't anymore, or they'll defeat the Night King and there'll be less to deal with, more than likely. Because it seems like Jamie's been very, very clear that we can't beat Dany's army as is, we just can't.
That's right.
You know, between dragons and the Dothraki, you've never seen anything like this. So, from a strategic standpoint, from a battle standpoint, it's like Cersei could be like, "Hey, we could go fight these people, and then we're gonna have to fight them again." So we're gonna lose people to work with them, and then we're probably gonna lose when the timeout is over. So this idea that, like, I mean, I don't even know that I necessarily fault Cersei's logic. Because I believe that she believes that this is a huge threat. And I think she also is like, yeah, and you know what? We're either going to die fighting them with them, or we can maybe just hope that they do it. And then we can, and we'll get
them. Well, here's the trouble with her logic. I think if it was two regular armies, it'd be like, well, let them bloody themselves, each other. And once they bloodied each other, then we'll face a weakened army, no matter who wins, right?
Right.
But the weakness in that logic is that
if the Night King wins, he gets more people.
His army's just gotten tons bigger. So.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that she knows. because we haven't seen.
Well, and I think exactly. I mean,
and I also get the sense that she's like, look, they can win, and well, I guess the thought is that she's like, look, if we go and it's a lost cause, then why die? What are we going to do? If we don't have enough to defeat this other army, how much more helpful is our army going to be? I don't know how much of this, but I guess I find her position to be less, not purely this, you know, one track minded. I still see it as a strategy.
I've always thought that she was a bit short-sighted, but in her defense, I guess you could say it's pretty rare for a cat, you know, you're in your fortified castle.
Mm.
It should take a lot for you to want to go out and meet an enemy on a field, especially an enemy who's like outnumbers you and all that business.
Yeah.
So traditional war tactics would be like, yeah, let's just bunker up here and see if they can actually get there, you know, all the way south. But clearly Jamie has other
ideas. Yeah. And I mean, I guess there is also the advantage too, if you stay back and say, look, here's what we know a little bit, right? We know that apparently dragon glass is a thing and fire is a thing. Let's just stay here and let's work on fire.
Well, the other thing about that is that, yeah, no, that's true. She's done well with wildfire in the past, right?
Yeah.
The other thing is that one of her main assets is that she's friendly with Euron, who has boats. And if she needs to get out of town because everything gets zombified, then she could, you know, she can escape with Euron.
Or you're a houseboat person, though.
Yeah, why not? That's a really not a bad, I mean, other than Euron.
Yeah.
Steve, you're not going to have Lord Baelish to kick around anymore.
No, it's a bittersweet thing, too. Because on one hand, it's like, all right, I think I mentioned this the last one. I was getting fatigued. And I don't know if it was fatigued because of him, but just like.
Well, he was getting speaking roles. He was great when he was just a face in the corner of the room.
Yeah. Well, he was just getting. Well, yeah, because we were getting a lot. And you realize how a little Lord Baelish goes a long way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as he was getting more and more into the plot, you're like, you know what? I really like it when you're complicating things from a different place. But when I have to watch you complicate things, I'm like, and then he just goes out like, of course, like I did like that. You know, on one hand, I was like, oh, this is a little over the top when he's on the ground begging for mercy. But at the same time, there was that sense of like, yeah, no, that's about right.
Well, it's really a magnificent scene. I mean, I've talked a lot of shit about this actor, but when he plays total, like he's totally sideblinded and totally confused that he's actually the one on trial.
Yeah, yeah, that's great.
And he knows that there's no, like he's playing every final card in his, that he thinks he has in the deck and nothing's working. That is quite a scene. It's quite a scene because number one, it's like, I think Sansa's fully realized at this point.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. I think, and this is what I was, you know, kind of, you know, you're hoping for, but you don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the moment where I think the last podcast, I think I was on record saying she sucks.
and now you know it. With her ambiguity, looks to be intentional now, I think.
Yeah, or even if she's a late bloomer and it all paid off. I mean, like either way, it's I think.
Well, the storyline doesn't work. The storyline for this particular season, I don't think works if you know that Sansa's mature enough to make peace with Arya and vice versa.
Right.
You don't get that reveal that actually these two are working together to work against Littlefinger unless you legitimately question whether or not Sansa is doing right by her sister, right?
So yeah, no, I get that.
So I love the payoff. I think that this episode was fantastic just for that reason, just to see Littlefinger go out like a punk. That was wonderful. I did think, I mean, there's a number of things that were quite awesome about this episode, and there was a lot of clunkiness in this episode too. So I actually made a little chart.
A clunk chart.
A clunk chart. So I'm going to tell you the things I thought were awesome on one side of the ledger first, okay? Yeah. The dragon pit scene, not actually the scene, but the build up to the dragon pit scene, I thought was really well done. I thought that was nice. The Littlefinger Sansa payoff was magnificent. The wall falling at the end of the episode.
Oh, man. Real good.
It was real. I had forgotten. I thought maybe that was a season 8 thing. I thought there's no. Yeah, this episode is packed. And then they end it on that note. That's just. Because the wall has been such an important set piece.
Well, the wall's a given. Narrative. It's just a given in the land.
That's right.
Oh, man, it's good.
Some of the reunions I thought were good. You know, I thought Brienne and the Hound talking about Arya, that was satisfying. And I did like Jon and Theon's showdown in the throne room. Because I really like the sense that Jon probably is still pretty pissed off at Theon.
Yeah, right.
And so. Yet, you know, he's willing to find at least a modicum of forgiveness. All right. So I liked all of those things. Here's my clunky side. John's speech about how if enough people lie, then the truth doesn't mean anything anymore, and lies aren't going to help us defeat the Night King.
Right, yeah.
Like, lies are not going to help you defeat the... No one said that they were... Like, actually, this is a situation where the lie actually might help you defeat the Night King.
Yeah, you've already, yeah.
Is the Night King, like, he's got a gas tank of falsehood? Like, the more falsehoods in the world, the stronger he gets? I didn't like
that. Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, I get you. That was where I was feeling a little, that's of all the things, this is probably the area that I had the most, like, okay, it's a little too Ned, too much Ned now.
Too much Ned.
For a guy who so fully understands what's at stake, that he's already jeopardized everything, right? He's jeopardized even his own potential, allies that he's forged, right? You know, and he's sort of made up some rules along the way, and he's made some choices that would run counter to this.
This is a guy that, as we've learned, can lie pretty well when he's undercover, right?
Sure.
He's not. This is not fully Ned's. Ned's son or whatever. This is a guy who can go undercover and lie to Mance Rayder.
He went full Donnie Brasco when it was time for some cave boning.
Well, okay, so I really thought so. I liked the Jon Theon showdown, and then I really didn't like the Theon fight.
Oh, you didn't like that?
Where his superpower is revealed.
Yeah. So you didn't think that was enough of a payoff?
I just thought, come on, man. This is such low-hanging fruit. You guys are better than this.
Maybe not. I didn't care. I still... I think my issue is that I don't know how invested I am in any more Theon adventures.
That's my point. And my point is that, look, I feel like his plot has been resolved when he makes peace with the people, you know, the guy who runs Winterfell. That's my feeling about Theon. Because Ramsay's dead, and his father's dead, and if he makes peace with Jon, and he's made peace with Sansa, I kind of don't care about him anymore.
You know, like you could have done it quicker too, for all I care. He goes in there, the guy's like, you know, I don't follow you. And he kicks him in the balls once, nothing happens. Then he just looks and then punches him or something. You know what I mean? Like, just do that. Like, I don't need a big drag out. And it's like, oh, well, here comes the finishing move. Ha ha. That finishing move.
That's the thing.
Work on
I guess
me.
That's right. If you're going to play that for a laugh, it probably works. But it seemed like that they were playing that more for some sort of grand climax of his character arc.
And look, now he's used this awful thing to his advantage. Maybe this will come in handy later. Like, no, I hope not. I mean,
this is actually, you know, we actually should be thanking Ramsay for cutting his junk off because, he would have never gotten to this point without Ramsay.
The Lord of Lights works in mysterious ways.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So, okay, so here's something that's interesting, that I think is interesting. So, because John's little speech doesn't really make sense, like, okay, so he's gonna refuse to play the Game of Thrones, and he's gonna do it at the worst possible time, and it's gonna sort of negate all of the horrible idea to go beyond the wall in the first place and capture a zombie. And everyone around John is like, what are you talking about? What are you doing? Like, you know.
Everybody.
Are you an idiot? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because it just seems so out of place. A lot of fans were like, oh, well, this has nothing to do with the story. This is a meta commentary on the 2016 election.
Huh?
Yeah. A lot of fans were going that direction. They were saying, John was not talking about, you know, lying to play the Game of Thrones. John was sort of doing a direct critique of a possible Trump administration.
Interesting.
That's what a lot of people thought. Like, it's a little
because it needs to be something. Because it needs to be something.
Like it seems so out of place that it was kind of like, what are they doing? Are you talking to Cersei? Are you talking to Trump? Like, what are you talking about? Who's line wasn't even part of the conversation in the first place.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean,
that's interesting.
Who knows? Who knows what that was? But that, again, it kind of gives you a little bit of a hint at, like, sometimes they can get too cute.
Right? Yeah. That's. And if that's the case, then yes, that is too cute, right? Because you're actually interrupting a story and a logical character arc.
Yeah.
To make another point, which you could probably find a way to make that point in another. You could have made that point where it's like, look, like Tyrion could tell him flat out, look, you may be asked to swear your fealty to Cersei in this, like prep him beforehand, and he could be like, well, I won't lie to her. Like, you can have that be the tension where he just takes it
aside. Either you bake in a character arc for Jon that has to do with the frailty of the realm because there's too many lies in the realm, right? So you got to start building that in from season one, and then this is the grand payoff,
right?
He's the guy that says, actually, lying is weakens us, it doesn't strengthen us, or whatever. Or you have him have that conversation with Littlefinger, who's lies are kind of what's holding all of the realm together and tearing it apart, depending on how Littlefinger is feeling that particular day, right?
Right.
So you kind of juxtapose John, who's the champion of truth, and Littlefinger, who's the champion of lies, and you have the good guy win. That would be another way to do it. To introduce it right at this moment, it just
and all the sta- when the stakes work. Are at their absolute highest.
Yeah, yeah.
And if there was ever a time where you could justify breaking a little bit of your own rules, it might be the very reason that like Cersei's trying to like at least at the moment we get the sense that she's willing to break even her own rules. I mean, her ideology suggests quite the opposite, and she's willing to because the threat's real. She at least gives the illusion at that moment that she's willing to do that, and so she lies. But that's, and I guess maybe that's the juxtaposition, is that at the end of all this, she ended up lying. She broke her oath. And
right.
So you know, and then.
Well, know. If that's the case, then it could be that they're trying to do a Ned parallel, because it's like, okay, Ned went south. He couldn't get out of his own way because he had a sense of honor, and Cersei ended up getting him in the end.
Yeah.
And you know, then, okay, and then it, look what happens to John. Couldn't get out of his own way because of his own honor, and now Cersei's gonna, you know.
Yeah, I think there's still a way to do it. You could still do that parallel, but not the delivery was this. The clunkiness, I think, is probably the bigger issue, right? And so clunky, I can deal with because I think I can sort of wrap my head around the idea of him not getting in his own way and the idea that all of a sudden, and that actually kind of works for me to some degree because it's like, look, just because he's been the king of the North for a couple of episodes doesn't mean he's now got it all figured out. I mean, how long has it taken for us to follow Sansa's journey here, right? And while John's whole thing, I mean, he was going to do it. He's been sort of frustratingly noble a lot, you know, on the wall, and he wouldn't go help Stannis, even though he knew it was probably the right thing. But it was like, nah. And then he had to be talked into fighting for his homeland. I mean, the whole thing, right? So it's like, but it is odd that this moment is the moment he chooses to be like, yeah, I know that this is probably the most important
worst
thing.
Possible moment.
I realize that I'm the one who's told everybody that we have to actually stop fighting because we're all going to die. We need to stop this by any means necessary. However, there's one means that you know,
for a show that's known, like, for not even known, but like really kind of set the bar for political intrigue, right? They do lean on the grandiose speech quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's every so often, it's like, you'll get something, like, yeah, this episode is great in the sense that, like, Littlefinger's little speech, like, okay, sometimes I play a little game, I imagine people's worst motives, and then I look and see what they're doing, and then I think, how well does the worst possible scenario explain what they've said and done? That's a great Game of Thrones moment.
Yeah.
And it just because there's like multi-layered narratives overlapping, it's like, okay, this has import for Arya. This has import for Sansa. It's just a great little Game of Thrones intrigue exposition. And you get a moment like that and you think, man, this show is really, really great. Really great. And then you... And then you get a moment like Jon Snow's speech, and you're thinking, oh, man, how did the same writer do both of those things?
Yeah, yeah.
Jon and Dany decide to take a boat together.
Yeah, I mean, that should have helped you.
Yeah. Okay, so they hook up in the boat, right? And then the camera kind of pans over to Tyrion doing his best Littlefinger... lurking expression.
Yeah.
What's going on in Tyrion's head? Like,
this is what I got the sense that this is what he wanted.
Okay. All right.
I got, because
when I first saw,
like,
that, I thought, oh, he's jealous. He's in love with her and he's jealous.
Oh no, I didn't get that at all. I got that. I got a sense of like, it's all coming together.
Cause he's not like rubbing his hands together.
No, but he gives, I think he gives a bit of a smile, doesn't he? He gives sort of an approving look. I got the sense anyway.
All right, I didn't get that. I didn't get that vibe. I just thought it was kind of creepy. That...
Also, you know, I mean, he's used to a certain amount of action, and at least being able to hear some action might be cool.
Yeah, he hasn't gotten that action in a while, actually.
Right. So big moments, right? I mean, we have, and I will say this felt a little rushed too. The Bran and Sam, hey, he's this. Oh my gosh, yeah, I totally read this. All right, well, who's gonna tell him? but there is this, like, again, I think what's happening is there's this sense of urgency, right? And it goes two ways for me. One is like, yeah, I'm feeling the sense of urgency. We're building towards the end. Let's go. Let's see what's going to happen. But then there's also the sense of urgency that feels like, yeah, we only have a few more of these. So let's just push this plot along a little bit. So while this episode had a lot, at times it felt like it might have been too much for one episode.
Sure.
Even though it was extended, just because there's a lot to like absorb and take in. Like there's a lot of moments where you're, and that's why I really appreciated the ending sequence with the dragons. I feel like that allowed it to take a little time as opposed to just showing up. Like they actually, you got a chance to really soak in the devastation and what that, and so I'm just the whole time going, my goodness, the entire landscape of Westeros is different now.
It's totally different. The wall is as much of a character in the show as any of the key characters, right?
Yeah. I do want to say this one thing. So seeing what the Night King was able to do with the dragon.
Yeah.
I'm even more in the camp of, that guy's got to end up on the throne.
It's one dragon against two.
It's one dragon against two, sure. But it's just, you got to give credit to the dead.
Well, here's the thing about that. He wasn't just able to use his magic blue ice fire or whatever it is to topple the wall. It kind of made a nice little path.
Yeah.
Like they didn't have to walk over rubble or anything.
No.
Because zombies don't really high step.
Right.
You needed a nice, smooth path right at the base of that wall.
So here's where I think I'm standing on this and why, like, for me, I'm not necessarily rooting for the Night King. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a monster. But in terms of logic, it seems really logical I don't see him sitting on the throne because I don't see him as a throne guy. I don't see him because the throne represents a certain political movement, and I don't see I just see it as sort of he's just laying waste.
He's got to sit somewhere sometimes, though, Steve.
Well, he says, yeah, dragon. I mean, sure, he could sit on that throne. He could sit over. So I get this feeling for me, and again, then maybe I have a darker sensibility, but that no matter what they do, like the whole story feels like a lesson. And it's like this whole, we've done this the whole time where it's been like, hey, we forget about the Night King, forget about them. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh crap, he's coming. And it could feel like a little bit of like, well, this is too little too late. There was a lot of human hubris and here we are, you know, here's the dead coming and we're still squabbling, you know, and this episode ends with this, there's still the sense of like,
There's still dissent. I mean, there's still a lot of political stuff that they need to figure out, right?
Right, and even now, Cersei, like, hey, we're gonna put everything aside to go fight this, and then you get somebody who's like, no, I think I can use this to my advantage, and that's the biggest ruse, right? That's the folly, right? Where it's almost like, you know what? I know I'm gonna die. I'm gonna keep playing this game until my last dying day, and as soon as I go to fight this thing, if I can't beat it, well, then who cares? I mean, why would I, if I want to fight, if I want to play the game till I die, why would I stop playing the game to go die? You know, like that's where I see that kind of an element with the Cersei, and the Jaime situation. And, there's so many other like little elements of undeadness and referencing to the dead and that which is dead will never die and all these different things, right? It's just like, so I just think like for me, I'm building up in, if I was in charge, I'd be building up to a crescendo that I'm sure would make a lot of people sad.
So, all right. So John and Danny, I'll talk a little bit about these guys. So George Martin has talked about how sometimes he'll do a three-stage reveal. So the first stage is kind of only for really savvy people that like can suss out clues, right? So he'll just drop a hint here and there. Like, you don't really know who John's mother is, right? And we know that Robert was really keen to kill all the Targaryen kids, right? So it's not a reveal, but it's kind of like this little breadcrumb. Like, if you're interested, you know, here's your first little hint. And then he'll do a second stage reveal where it's like, oh my gosh, John is, you know, John's scene is cut together right after this Tower of Joy scene. And so most watchers will be like, oh, whoa, John's actually a Targaryen, right?
Yeah.
And then he'll do like a third stage reveal where it's someone talking right to your face, explaining to you exactly what that means. Like, his name is Aegon Targaryen. He is the
right.
He is the heir to the Iron Throne. It's like the third stage for like, hey, dummy, if you haven't gotten it already, let me explain to you so that we're all on the same page going forward. And I kind of feel like it's a pretty effective way to tell a story. But when you get to the third stage, don't belabor it. You know, do, you know, hit me over the head with a 2x4, but move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
So it could be that that's what they were doing. That like, most people already know this already. So let's not belabor the point. Let's just kind of come out and say it and move on or whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
But here's my question to you. At this point, do you have a sense of what John and Danny's relationship is?
Not really.
Like biologically?
No. I'm trying to figure that out, right? Because I understand.
So Rhaegar was supposed to be her older brother, which would make her
his aunt?
Yeah, his aunt.
Okay.
So, does that make you feel any differently about the sex scene on the boat?
Well, I imagine it's supposed to, right? I mean, because I already got the sense that there's a relation, I didn't know what the relation was, so I just was like, this isn't.
This is what Game of Thrones has done to you, Steve. You've seen so much incest. That it's like,
how bad
she's
is
she's probably this? Related to him somehow. Give me a break.
How bad is this incest, though? No, so I did have the sense of like, I don't know how related these two are. So I think if that's what was supposed to be felt, I did feel very uncomfortable during the sex scene. Cause I'm like, oh no. Like, okay.
It was in the back of your head that thinking these two are some kind of distant cousin or something. Right.
Yeah, that's what I had said. I said, yeah, Heather's take was that they were distant cousins. I said, I think they could be cousins. I don't know how distant.
Yeah, he's her nephew. That's the issue.
That's actually kind of sweet.
There's something
different about it. Like if it was an uncle, ugh. What if it's an aunt?
Well, I think it
notice
is
how I said aunt. I softened it. I don't use that term. I use aunt. I have an aunt. But when it's when it's incestuous, I prefer aunt.
Yeah. No. There's something old world charming about it when you say aunt.
Yeah.
Right? Is auntie worse or better?
Oh, worse.
Too familiar.
Yeah. There's hard candy involved.
So, knowing that, I think what they're going for, and probably what Martin's going for here, is some kind of weird Greek Oedipus thing, where it's like these two people don't really know who each other are to each other, and so they've stumbled onto this ironic tragedy. You know, they think they're in a comedy. They actually live in a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people didn't quite get that. I think there were a lot of people that were just like, yeah, well, it's not that big of a deal. A lot of Targaryens had incest in the past, and It's just, you know, different culture. This is how it's done. And I'm thinking, if that's the first scene of the show, that would be as jarring as Jaime and Cersei.
For sure. I think. 100%. Yeah. So I do think it's a big deal. So to me, that's, and I actually, I mean, I think it's great. I think it's, you know, I mean, it's no child getting burned for the Lord of Light's great, but it's great in the sense that the show, like going back to that sense of like sense of urgency and trying to wrap things up and tidy things up, like, this certainly isn't tidy.
Yeah, right.
And so I feel like it's a necessary, it's more than a speed bump in my opinion. I don't know how it's going to be handled, obviously, but I do find myself very intrigued by this. Well, you know, you root for them to get together, and then now you're like, well, in order for me to still do that, I have to be cool with some things real quick.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the clunkiness before, but the brilliance of the storytelling is not lost on me in that some fans are going to read it like a speed bump.
Mm-hmm.
And then some fans are going to be more like you and think, oh no, this is a huge complication. And I'm not sure what to think about this, how things are going to play out at this point. Right.
Right.
Cause I think if it was any other story, these two would fall in love and live happily ever after, or something like that. Or
right.
They die in each other's arms, or, you know,
as I've been trying to like piece together how this all sort of ends and how, you know, like, and again, I'm trying to piece together not only how I think it should end, how I think it will end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because those are probably two separate things at this point, I would imagine, because I have yet to concoct an ending that I hate. I think I may be looking at this too simplistically too. I might just be like, who ends up on the throne? Which of these would I have a problem with? Right. I mean, and like, I'm honestly like, I'm at the point now, I'm like, dude, if Hot Pie's on the throne, I want a whole sequel series. you know, again, I think we've already talked about it. I mean, Game of Scones sounds amazing.
Game of Scones. That's a wonderful t-shirt, by the way.
I think that the concern is like, it's the challenge of investment is what I keep going back to. That's the most logical disappointment to me is I've invested this much time and energy, and then this is the payoff after all this. So I'm trying to figure out if it is this, you know, again, I don't know what the problem is. Is it the problem of who ends up on the throne, or however they resolve the throne issue? Is it a issue of how we get there? Is it the it gets super clunky, there's too much fan service,
all of the above?
Right. Well, that's the other part, right? And like, it's just an orgy.
At the end of this episode, it seems impossible that would be the case, because
for sure,
even though this episode's clunky from time to time, it still has these wonderful moments.
And again, it finishes on a romantic complication that is like these, it's pretty massive, right? I mean, it's a massive moment, because here it is, we're like, it's a complication because they're getting together and you're kind of conditioned to root for it. So it feels like we're moving towards our happily ever after coupling. And right out the gate, it just can't work. The only way that they could work is if they just don't find out. And even then, that's a tough one to keep, right?
It's a tough secret to keep, for sure. Especially if Bran knows, because Bran has no filter anymore.
Well, Bran has zero bedside manner.
Bran, you'll be like just out to coffee with Bran, and he'll be like, hey, by the way, I found out your great-grandfather was a Nazi. I just saw it in a vision.
Yeah, not a lot. I don't know how bad, but, you know, I'll let you wrestle with that. On to the next.
I could have lived without that information, Bran.
Yeah, Bran is now like a combination of Bruce Almighty and Rain Man.